Years to Life show, the show that spotlights and investigates new developments in integrative cancer care, developments across the full spectrum of conventional and complementary methods, and particularly the ways in which they can work together to improve outcomes and quality of life. This week's show is on a subject that's very dear to me, patient experience. Too many of us have experienced a huge gap between the importance given to the clinical outcome and to the patient experience. It is literally possible to have a good clinical outcome that leaves a patient wishing they weren't alive. Healthcare is a culture that has been universally focused solely on clinical outcome as the measure of success. This has created a situation in which medical triumphs are often viewed as some of the worst things that ever occurred to patients, and in which they were disrespected, misinformed, and for which they pay a huge price. So I was very excited to hear that Macmillan Cancer Care has taken up the challenge to establish patient experience on a par with clinical outcome as a measure of success. To rebrand a clinical success that's accompanied by a terrible patient experience as a failure and a pointer to change. This led me to contact Macmillan, and Tom Cottam, the policy manager for the charity, kindly agreed to be interviewed for the show. I travelled to Macmillan headquarters on the south bank of the Thames to meet him. Good morning, Tom. Many thanks for coming on the show today to talk about issues surrounding the experience of cancer patients going through treatment in our NHS. Good morning. The reason I'm talking to you today is because I was inspired by hearing your chief executive, Linda Thomas, setting out an aim for Macmillan of putting patient experience on a par with clinical outcomes. I thought, yes. I'm absolutely delighted to be discussing this, in fact, because it's something that's really concerned me deeply for years. But as we run a very small charity concerned with other things, can't really extend to that. So it's great to have the weight of Macmillan behind making some changes in this area. So a press release of yours last month said that almost half of all cancer patients surveyed in the Cancer Patient Experience Survey, CPES, a national survey of over 71,000 cancer patients, said that staff didn't fully explain the potential long-term side effects that they could face. So these could include debilitating illnesses such as heart conditions, swelling limbs, or issues with fertility, to which I'd add, actually, often the people who call us haven't been told that the radiotherapy they're having could cause them cancer in years to come. So these are major omissions. So it's a pretty shocking revelation when it's something so basic, but we're kind of used to it, unfortunately, here. So how optimistic are you about making changes to this kind of situation, and what is it that really needs to change, in your opinion?
So I think we can be optimistic, but there is obviously work to be done. So I think on a positive note, the Cancer Patient Experience Survey, both in England and in Scotland, has demonstrated that overall people's experience of care is actually relatively good. But as you say, there's areas of poor practice that we need to address. So as you mentioned, people not being told about the long-term side effects of their treatment, but also people not receiving a care plan, kind of outlining both the assessment of their needs and then what care they might need to receive as their treatment progresses and beyond treatment in order to address those needs. So that's why we think it's really important that actually patient experience is at the heart of everything the NHS does, is a priority for government, and staff in the NHS, nurses and doctors, are empowered to actually make sure that they're delivering the best possible care to patients.
Okay. So what areas actually need to change, do you think, for this to happen? Is this a kind of systems thing? Is this a training issue? Is it, you know, where do the problems really lie, do you think?
So I think there's, in some of the areas that we've identified, so the issues about people not having those conversations to ensure that people really understand what the long-term side effects are of treatment, but also not receiving things like a care plan. I think those we know that people within the NHS are under huge amounts of pressure at the moment. The vast majority of the staff are trying to deliver the best possible care and do deliver excellent care to people affected by cancer. But there are simple things that can be done, both at a national level. So I think, as I said, it needs to be a priority for government and governments across the UK to actually ensure that for them, cancer patient experience is a priority. At a kind of more local level, I think, where some of this change can be driven, there's simple things that can be done. So McMillan has developed with patients something called the value-based standard, which is a second set of recommendations which outlines what staff can do to support patients and to ensure they have the best possible experience of care. And there's a really great example of where staff of a group of nurses have actually used those recommendations in order to drive care. So what they did is engage with patients, people who had head and neck cancer and were undergoing treatment, and actually overhauled the menu that people had in the hospital, so the hospital food.
Right.
Because based on the experience of their engagement, they found that actually lots of people who had head and neck cancer couldn't actually eat a lot of what's on the menu. So by using that really simple tool, where they're able to engage with patients in the right way and really overhaul their experience. And it seems like a simple thing, but actually it had quite profound impact. So I think there is a national thing that all governments and kind of leaders within the NHS need to be ensuring that the patient experience is fundamental to what the health service and the NHS is trying to deliver. But there's also those things that are at a kind of more operational level within hospitals that can be done, and staff can actually be driving that change.
Okay, great. So, as we said at the outset, it's a very intractable kind of area of medicine that many people, successive governments have been trying to change for a long time. The terms patient-centered care and patient choice have been consistently bandied around for about four decades now, I think. And there's lots of posts within the NHS that contain the words patient-centred or choice or something, but the experience on the ground hasn't moved proportionately. I think it's important to note that the problem it's not a UK problem, it's actually in health services around the world. And I know this from people who actually work in this area trying to campaign to change this. It's just the same everywhere. And so it's a curious sort of problem, which is to do with the industry, if you like, of healthcare. It has taken a very long time to even begin to make these changes. What do you think are the things that are actually holding it back? Why hasn't it, considering they set out to make these changes 40 years ago, why haven't we made more progress?
In England, for instance, we recently, in the last two or three years, had the mid-staffs and the issues that arrived from the mid-staffature report. And I think that has kind of put patient experience at the heart of what the NHS is trying to do.
Made it a headline
issue. Yeah, and I think that was kind of a bit of a wake-up call for the NHS, that if you don't recognise the importance of patient experience and how people experience their care, then it can lead to quite systemic and fundamental changes and challenges within trust and within the NHS. So I think it was a bit of a wake up call, and I think what we've seen is a shift in the culture within the NHS, within governments, to actually start to take this seriously. And I think what we're talking about is ensuring that it is on par with clinical outcomes. I think we've for a long time made huge progress in improving survival rates in cancer, which is fantastic, and that means that people are living longer and are surviving cancers now that they wouldn't have been able to survive 10 years ago, 20 years ago, which is obviously a real positive. But I think we're now starting to recognise that is not the only outcome that we want to achieve.
Right. So there was your great recent campaign to highlight the lot of people who've come right through cancer treatment and are living afterwards, and go on the survival statistics looking good, but actually the quality of their lives is not being really looked at all, and some of them are atrociously poor. So yeah, these are huge issues, these kind of things. I know this is the patient experience. They're a success story, but they don't feel like one.
No, I think that's, as I say, there are changes within the NHS at the moment, which I think are cultural changes, are about trying to move from that, how do we focus solely on making sure people survive cancer, and recognising that the changing story of cancer is that more and more people are surviving cancer, which is fantastic news, but lots and lots, as you say, lots and lots of those people will go on to live, you know, for many years with the impacts of their cancer, and quite often experience poor health. So what McMillan is doing through our campaign is trying to highlight those needs and ensure that everything that we're doing within the NHS is is trying to reflect that that is a changing story of cancer. And for instance, one of the things that we're doing is trying to ensure that quality of life is actually measured in the NHS. But currently it's not. So you can measure survival rates, but you can't measure quality of life. And currently it's you can measure patient experience, but it's ensuring all of those things are seen as just as important as each other and make up the story of what people experience their day-to-day lives with cancer are. So it's really important that we're able to actually ensure that the experience, quality of life sits alongside how people survive, and that drives what the NHS is trying to do and deliver for people affected by cancer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting because it's a whole new challenge to actually find out how to measure these things in a way that really means something, isn't it?
So I think, I mean, with patient experience, Macmillan has been really supportive of the Cancer Patient Experience Survey, which has been a fantastic tool both nationally to understand what does the experience of cancer patients look like, mm-hmm. and be able to measure that in a way that reflects what is important to people affected by cancer. But it's also really fundamental for a trust, a hospital, to actually be able to understand what do the results say for their patients, and based on that, what do they actually need to do to actually be able to drive the change that matters to patients. So that is a really significant advancement for being able to measure patient experience and be able to then understand where do you need to be able to make change and drive change.
Mm-hmm. So that survey, I think it wasn't a Macmillan initiative, but you've been involved in the development of it, is that right?
We've really pushed to ensure that across the UK those surveys are happening. It's really demonstrated its value in England, and it's something that we're really proud to have been part of, making sure that it's continued and its value is really understood. And so I think both that ensuring that at a national level it's got the support across the UK, but also then working with local healthcare organisations and trusts to actually understand their results and understand how they can drive improvements on the back of it. And as I said, what Macmillan has done through the value-based standard, which is these series of recommendations which was developed with patients, is provide a tool for people to be able to understand their results and understand how they can engage patients to deliver a better experience. Mm.
So this has been rolled out across England. You were saying Scotland is now also...
Yeah, so we've now got results in Scotland, which is fantastic.
And they're programmed to be Wales and Northern Ireland as well.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, so look, I just want to go back. It's interesting, we've been talking quite a bit about these two sort of targets. Well, there's the clinical outcome and there's the patient experience. And they're very different target, and I think you're right in as much as saying that healthcare has been entirely focused on clinical outcomes, so you could have survived cancer but be living in hell, and that was a good outcome, you know, and that was what was being measured. So it's a very important distinction to have between these two things, but of course they're completely intertwined, in fact, aren't they? And the example that came to my mind is, you know, you take your car in for a service and you get it back 3 days later and you expect to get it back at the end of the day. The guy was rude on the phone, very unhelpful, the paperwork was terrible, and, you know, all of that. And he gives you the car back in and says, what on earth are you whinging about? It works fine, I've done a great job. And really, you know, you wouldn't go back to it. You just wouldn't, would you? But, of course, we don't have the choice not to go back to the NHS here. So it's imperative that the NHS wakes up to the fact that that is not a whole service to people, you know, it's just one part of it. And they, of course, you're absolutely right, they do an awful lot of the things that the NHS does, they do in an exemplary way, you know, their acute care is like world class, there's no doubt about it. So, but, you know, then alongside there can be these massive faux pas about, you know, the way people are talked to, you know, it's really basic stuff. So, huge gap in attention, if you like. So.
Yeah, and I, as I say, I think it's a cultural change that we're grappling with, and
yeah,
I think
right.
you can see through the Cancer Patient Experience Survey that actually there are areas that are very good. So 87% of people are say that they're treated with dignity and respect. So I think that's something that we need to be able to recognise and applaud, but at the same time ensure we do recognise those areas where improvements need to be made, that people need to have a care plan and that should be routine. People need to have those quality discussions about what might be the impact of their radiotherapy, and that those things are we're driving change in those things just as much as recognising the improvements that have been made. So I think in terms of what McMillan is trying to make sure that everyone understands is that balance, is that we do need to ensure we are delivering the best possible treatments and people have access to the drugs they need, but also that you don't forget about what happens when treatment finishes. We know that many patients feel like when treatment finishes, they are dropped. And that is so fundamental to their experience and their quality of their life. So it's, you know, as you say, you can have the best possible treatment, but actually if you're not told about the consequences of what that treatment might be, and then, you know, in months down the line, you have unexpected consequences of treatment, you don't know how to manage them, you don't know who to contact because your treatment has finished, that it can be devastating for some people and have a really fundamental impact on what they feel their quality of life is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe we could just talk about a few of the actual areas that you're hoping to address with all of this. I mean, I don't know exactly what the survey covers, but I mean, I can think of a few, and I'm sure you can think of a few more. But we've already mentioned the whole dignity and respect thing, you know, literally talking to people in a reasonable way, knowing people's names. And delivery of difficult news, that's another one that needs work, I think. But you've got this values-based standard you've developed. Maybe you could tell me a bit about that, how it applies in this area.
Okay, so I think what McMillan recognised was that now with the Cancer Patient Experience Survey, there was a huge amount of data that was available to kind of national leaders within the NHS, to clinicians on the ground. But what was going to be challenging was actually how do you use that? How do you use it to make sure it's not just something that is that we have the data, fantastic, but actually it's actually driving improvements. That's the important thing about the Cancer Patient Experience Survey. It's not seen as a target, but it's seen as something that's going to drive improvements and transformation in the way we deliver care. So what McMillan did was to develop what we've called the value-based standard, which is quite simply a set of recommendations. It was developed with patients, developed with healthcare professionals, and it's there as a tool to support professionals to understand how they can work with patients to deliver improvements in their care. So I mentioned that one example where it was used in order to have those conversations to understand that actually people with head and neck cancer couldn't eat what was on the menu in their hospital. Mm-hmm. And to understand that and to actually drive improvements to ensure that you change the menu, that you actually the menu was appropriate to what people couldn't eat based on the side effects of their treatment. And that had a really profound impact on both the patient experience, but also empowering the nurses that drove that improvement to understand that they're not passengers in this. They are actually going to be the people that drive care and transformation on the ground.
I'm very pleased to hear it. I think, I mean, to me, there's a huge well of resource in the nursing staff who would love to do things better, but literally they don't have the means and the kind of cultural backing to do it. That's my experience. And that if you give them, press the go button, they make things better in no time at all.
And I think the key thing there is about ensuring that staff are empowered to deliver those changes. And there's a whole number of things. You've mentioned it can be time, it can be having time to go off and do some training that allows them to understand how they can better deliver care. And I think what we know as well is that if staff have a poor experience, it is likely that they will deliver a poor experience to patients. Absolutely. And really understanding the link between if you've got a highly motivated workforce, they are going to deliver a better experience of care. Yeah. And I think that's a really important thing for us all to understand, that this is not just about the patients. Obviously, they are fundamentally important, but it's about supporting the staff to deliver the best possible care. So there's a role for everyone in that. There's a role for, as I said, there's a role for the NHS, there's a role for governments ensuring that they are recognised the value of their workforce in order to be able to deliver the best possible care to people affected by cancer.
Mm. All right. And this value-based standard, is this something which is going to lead to a reasonable expectation of patients that they will be treated in a particular way?
Erring a little bit just in terms of my kind of the extent, I wasn't involved in the development of it. I think my view of the value-based standard, what I understand about it, is that it's a tool that is there available that we can guarantee that it reflects what is important to patients, that is available to work so healthcare professionals can work with patients to deliver the best possible care. the cultural change that is required in order to ensure the patient experience is at the heart of everything the NHS needs to do is something that that's going to have to continue, and something everyone has a role in. And so it's not just going to be the value-based standard that's going to enable us to deliver that. It's a tool that will enable us to understand what patients want and to deliver change on the ground. But that kind of cultural change is something that we're going to have to continue. And I think if you look at the recent cancer strategy in England as an example, we were very pleased. We pushed for really hard, and we were very pleased that it was recognised that patient experience needs to be on a par with clinical outcomes. So that's the sort of change we need to see and continue to see. But obviously, ensuring that something is a strategy at a national level is a start, and it's not what's going to deliver change on the ground. But it's something that it's all part of the journey that we need to ensure continues.
Right. Well, good. But I ask that because in so many areas of healthcare now, change is actually being driven by patient demand. People are far less likely to just sit back and accept them and they give them now. They get out there, they find out things for themselves, they want information, they want to make decisions. And those kind of people don't really like being treated with disrespect when they know a lot about their condition and they're being talked to as though they're idiots. That kind of scenario, for example. So it would be helpful for those people, I feel, to know that there is a standard that actually is expected of healthcare professionals, that just very basic things they do that. And so they can then politely say, oh, by the way, the way you're talking to me is actually not the way the NHS is supposed to run. And they'd have ground to stand on.
And I think the other thing to mention is the fact that there is this data that's available, and how do you make that available to patients? So something that Macmillan has been pushing for, as well as developing kind of innovative tools like the value-based standard, has also been pushing to ensure that what comes out of the cancer patient experience survey is actually used not only by trust, but it is actually used to measure the performance of your local cancer commissioning group.
Well, that's something I was just going to ask about. Brilliant. I mean, that's great. So people will actually be able to see. I've used a similar kind of method myself. Yeah. I needed to go to a walk-in clinic today, right, in London. And I thought, I'd never been to one. There are two there. And I just got on the internet, read the comments about one of them, read the comments about the other. No question about it. I'm going to that one. You know, they all said it's rubbish. And these people all say these people are fantastic. And they were. So the fact that information is generally out there for people to see, oh, these people are really treating their patients well. They love going there. They think they've been... had a fantastic result. Yeah. It's great that that information is public.
And there's a role for us all to ensure that information is actually properly available to patients in a way that people can actually, you know, you don't need to be an expert to go and find out about the that. So there is still work to do, but recognising that data from the Cancer Patient Experience Survey provides such a rich wealth of data that not only works for, as I say, to ensure that at a national level we're prioritising the right things, at a local level that clinicians understand where they're going wrong and where they can improvements, but also for patients to be able to be more informed about their care and the quality of the service available to them.
And I think we could quickly move from a feeling of like, well, this information is sort of the blacklist, the people are not really doing it well, to being this information is in order to highlight the places that are exceptional, which is what we're all after.
And I think we know that the Cancer Patient Experience Survey in England tells us that in the North East, for instance, they're actually far better than the national average at ensuring people have a care plan and ensuring people are talked, you know, there's a conversation about the consequence of their treatment. And I think what's really valuable about knowing that is that other areas can look at that and learn
how they can do it,
how they can improve. And I think you're right, it's not about naming and shaming necessarily. I think it's about ensuring we're highlighting that best practice and sharing it across the NHS and learning what they're doing well in Scotland and in Wales and what can happen in England. So I think that's the real value of those case studies and ensuring that information is shared and highlighted.
And I think it very much comes back to what you were saying earlier, and that you can get this kind of movement going, which is in order to improve the service and to deliver a great patient experience, the enthusiasm of the staff goes up like mad. You know, the staff experience becomes much better, and that kicks back into a better patient experience. You know, it's all linked together. As long as the whole thing's being held down to saving money, getting a good clinical outcome, then everybody is oppressed, basically. Yeah.
And some of these things, I mean, some of the, you know, ensuring that you ask the patient you're caring for what name they want to be called by,
right,
and treating them as a person, right, doesn't necessarily cost money to do that. No. I mean, I'm not saying it's kind of always easy. People are under a lot of pressure, but I think there's lots of these changes that can be made if they're highlighted in the right way, that you can actually start to drive these changes that aren't necessarily going to be based on the availability of more money, but it's about being able to ensure we can recognise what's important to patients, make that visible, and then kind of work together to drive those changes. Mm.
Well, I mean, I've seen studies into this kind of area which clearly show that if you actually treat people well, they are much less demanding, basically. They're, you know, they're happy. So the drain on the staff is much less. So, you know, it's actually an improvement. It doesn't take more time, it takes less.
And I think what we know from our work with people who are living with beyond cancer, what's really important is ensuring that they have the tailored support that is right for their needs, and sometimes that might be about ensuring that someone is able to manage their own healthcare, is given the tools and the support to be able to, once they've finished treatment, to be able to understand what might be the long-term consequences of their treatment. That's a discussion that's had with them, and then they're given support to manage their care, and I think that is an example of where you can start to reduce sometimes the reliance on the healthcare system. But it's about ensuring that those conversations are had, and it's about ensuring that we are listening to patients and giving them the support that is right for them, rather than trying to kind of a one-size-fits-all approach. So I think there are ways in which if people better understand the needs of the patients they're dealing with and can have those quality conversations, you can start to deliver care in a more effective way.
Mm-hmm. So it's a kind of, it's a bigger view in a way, that the clinical outcomes target tends to have a rather short-term aim, doesn't it? It's like, we get this fixed and get you out of that bed and you're done, you know, signed off, end of job. Whereas when you engage with the patient experience, you're much more likely to then be looking at their whole life, how it goes, and of course, all what happens in future comes back to the health service again. So if you don't deal with the consequences of that piece of clinical treatment well, then you're going to pay for it later when they come back again, because you haven't prepared them.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a really great example of that exact case we heard about, where someone who was undergoing radiotherapy didn't understand the impact. There wasn't a conversation about the impact of that treatment, and the fact that actually it could have an impact on the strength of your bones, and actually ended up breaking their pelvis as a result of their radiotherapy, because that was not a conversation that was had, which meant that was kind of an unexpected outcome of their treatment, which obviously not only has an impact on their kind of physical needs, but has a huge impact on their kind of well-being and their ability to cope with what is already a really stressful situation. So it just shows the importance of some of those kind of what feel like sometimes simple things, as you say, can actually have an impact on their longer term physical health, but also their well-being and their emotional health as well.
Yeah. Okay, another point that I hope this is all addressing will be the one we've talked about, which is fully informing patients so that they can make informed choices. There is a criticism often levelled that people are not basically treated as though they're capable of making an informed choice. So they're just told some very simplistic picture that you know, and you should start this on Monday, and that's it. So I'm sure this is something you are working to change. And of course, an informed patient makes much better choices for themselves. They're much more likely to have a good experience as a result.
Yeah.
How do you think your work's going to address that kind of situation?
So I think what Macmillan has been prioritising and calling for is ensuring that everyone has a needs assessment, assesses their kind of, not just their clinical needs, but what might be their financial needs that arise from their cancer treatment. What are their emotional support needs? And that is something that is done with the patient. You know, so you get a really good understanding about what the needs of that patient will be given their circumstances.
Exactly. Yeah.
And it's not, as I say, not just based on their clinical needs or what treatment they might undergo, but is actually looking at their kind of their full life and recognizing them as a full person. What's really, really important then is again that that's not a static document. That based on that, that there you start to pull together a care plan, which we've talked about. But again, that plan is not just trying to address their clinical needs, but is looking at what action might be required and what support can that patient receive to address their financial needs or their emotional support needs. But again, what's really critical is that that is something that is a living, breathing document that changes based on the changing needs of that person.
Right.
So it might be that you start it when at the point of diagnosis, but then you start to think about, well, when they finish treatment, how do their needs change? So that's something that we think is really, really important, what Millen thinks is really important to ensure that people's needs are assessed, that people have a care plan, but that is an ongoing conversation between the patient and the clinicians.
So how is the thread of that tied together? I mean, the care plan itself is obviously something that exists along the way and gets developed, but in terms of human resources, who's the link? Is it the patient or is it their GP or who's carrying it forward?
I think that can be that will depend on the patient's circumstances. So it could be their clinical nurse specialist, so it could be a McMillan nurse who has that conversation. I think what we know is really, really important at those transition points that the patient knows who is responsible for their care. Yeah, so that we know is it can be a challenge.
Yeah.
And that's something that sometimes is where it goes wrong. Is that that's true where people might be leaving hospital and might be
go back
into the community. We know that that can be a challenge. Mm-hmm. So there's work to be done there to ensure that journey for that person and that you're not constantly having to repeat your story. We know that's something
is
something that really frustrates people who are with cancer. Is at every point they're having to repeat their story. And that can feel very frustrating and have an impact on your experience of care.
Yeah.
So that's something, there is work to be done there to ensure that journey there's continuity and consistency mm-hmm. And that people, that I say that care plan isn't just relevant to when they're in hospital and they're undergoing treatment, but also perhaps when they've finished treatment and they might be back within their community setting, that is something that continues. So there is work to be done there.
Mm. Okay, well, a kind of associated problem that I've experienced now, I find is worrying because a lot of these things affect the trust in the relationship between the practitioners and the patient, I think. You know, how they're talked to and whether they're told the right information and everything. If they find things out afterwards, like the person you just described, you find that out down the line, you broke your pelvis just because they didn't tell you, you should look after it. You suddenly lost faith. You think, well, are these people as good as they cracked up to be? It doesn't do anything for the relationship. Another sort of associated issue is what I would call an incremental supplying of information. People come in and they're given the information that the practitioners think they can handle. So they say, right, well, we're coming on Monday and we're going to do this. And you come in on Monday, you do the thing, but they didn't tell you that. And while they're doing that, they're going to give you this drug in order to alleviate this and this and this, and this one's going to make you drowsy, and this one's make you feel a bit sick, and whatever it is. And then, you know, the next day you find out, well, actually those three drugs have all got side effects, and you actually are going to need this drug and this drug, and you're constipated now because of this drug. And, you know, by the Friday, you're absolutely out of it. You know, you're just completely dosed up on drugs, and it's nothing like what you thought you were being led into on Monday.
Mm.
Now, you know, it's not that people would say, no, I'm not going there if you told them the whole story, but it's simply that if you do that to people, I think they feel bad, basically. Why didn't they tell me this on last Friday when I came to the appointment? This is what's happening on Monday. And that is normal. I think I've come across it everywhere. So I don't know if it's something that's on the radar of kind of dealing with patients and giving them good information.
I think that's something we know from the Cancer Patient Experience Survey, that actually the quality of the information that's provided, the quality of the conversations, as I said, we know that about just under half of people are not having those conversations
right.
about the impact of their treatment, about what treatment they're receiving and what they can expect because of that treatment. So it comes, as you say, as a shock, sometimes for 50% of the people. That is something that we need to really prioritise and recognise and ensure that we don't lose what we've learned from the Cancer Patient Experience Survey and ensure that we're driving change. I think one of the things that can be a bit of a vehicle for ensuring those conversations are had is going back to those holistic needs assessments, or ensuring that that is not just a document and a tick box, but is actually a vehicle for people having really good quality conversations with patients, and ensuring that there's an opportunity for people to ask those questions, and that information feels like it's been delivered and understood and engaged with. I think there are some things that allow that provide the support for clinicians and healthcare professionals who we know are under quite often under significant pressure to be able to ensure that those conversations have been had.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and of course it doesn't have to come from the top man, does it? This kind of thing can come from a well-informed person who's got the time. You know,
yeah.
They don't have to be the most expensive person on the block to deliver all the details in that way, but it's also, of course, it's difficult because the patient's going into completely new territory. Usually they don't know anything about it. They've heard of chemotherapy, they don't know what it is, they didn't want to know. Most people don't even want to know about cancer treatment because they're hoping they won't go there. But so, you know, they're in shock, you know, very often, and so the delivery of information is a difficult one. I mean, you can't just burden somebody with a huge amount of information. They won't take it in, and they won't absorb it properly. But it's not a reason to keep it away from them either. They should have as much information as they want.
Yeah,
basically.
And I mean, as you say, that's a difficult challenge, and lots of healthcare professionals are balancing out that you know, at a time of diagnosis when you've just been told you've got cancer. Mm. Being given reams and reams and reams of literature to read is often not what patients want.
No.
And we know that. So it's about finding the right time to deliver that information. As you say, it's about ensuring that you're not making an assumption that they don't need to know the information.
Exactly.
You're not making an assumption that they want it all, but you're talking to them about kind of and trying to assess what is the best time to give them. So it might be ensuring that that information is kind of sent following the treatment or there's an appointment made with a nurse or with information professionals to ensure that as a follow-up, people are able to, when they might be better placed to absorb that information, it happens at that point. So it is a very difficult balancing
it's
act.
It's difficult, and the thing is, of course, everybody's different.
Yes.
And some people want all the information now, on day one, and other people, they're quite happy to just be told the basics. But if you're not interested in the patient themselves, you'll have a "this is what we do" kind of attitude. We give you this much information, and it'll suit some of the people in the middle, but the ones at either end will be completely out of it. It won't suit them at all.
And I think that, I mean, obviously Macmillan provides a huge amount of information about cancer, about the financial needs, about the long-term side effects, and I think we're very aware of the different ways in which people will want information.
Yeah.
So it might be that at a consultation, what you are signposting people to a website for people who that might be appropriate to, or you're giving them the phone number of the Macmillan support line, or you're signposting to the information centre within their hospital.
Right.
So there's a whole variety of ways in which people can receive information and what's right to them. I think the point you've made is completely right, that you understand what is right for that patient.
No,
you don't assume it. And
this is patient-centered care.
Yes.
Yeah. All right. So respect for patients' individual choices. But the patient's criteria for choices might be completely different to the consultant who's giving them advice. This is something we come across quite often.
Mm.
People have been literally shouted at, told they're idiots and all the rest of it, because they make a choice. They decide, well, you know, on balance, they say, well, that treatment is going to reduce my quality of life. I'd rather not do it. Thanks very much. I just have even if my life is going to be shorter, I don't want that.
Mm.
Thanks. And so there's only one person who should be able to make that decision. That's the person who's, it's their body, their life. But nonetheless, those kind of choices which might go against what is being advised are not respected in a lot of instances. Is this something, again, that your scheme is hoping to influence?
I think we, again, you know, cancer patient experience is made up of a whole variety of things, as you said. It's not just you do this one thing and you get a great experience.
Yeah.
One of those things is ensuring that people feel like their decisions are made with them or by them, not about them, and not for them on their behalf. Again, it comes down to what is right for that individual. And there might be individuals who want to be completely in control of their care, mm-hmm. and there might be individuals who want that kind of guidance and advice.
Absolutely.
And it's about understanding. And at the heart of kind of good patient-centered care is ensuring that you understand what the needs and how a patient wants to be treated and how they want to be involved in their care. And part of that is just making sure you have those quality discussions and those conversations. And in that instance, it's ensuring that there is that. It's not just a kind of one-way conversation, say this is the treatment you're going to be getting. That it's fully explained about why that might be the best option, what might be the side effects, what will be the impact on that person's health. And that it feels like a shared decision between the clinician and between the patient in terms of what might be the right course of action for that mm-hmm. patient. So I think what we know from the Cancer Patient Experience Survey is A, that's really, really important to patients, and B, those areas where that can be improved. And there's lots of ways in which you can improve that. It can be about kind of communication skills and ensuring that the people are given the right training and support, and ensuring that they are able to have those conversations. Sometimes it's about time and things like that. So I don't think it's one fix for that, but you're right. Saying we know it's important to patients, and we know that when it's got right, the impact on people feeling like they've been empowered and able to make and involved in those decisions can be really significant, even potentially if clinically their outcome is poor, can make a really big difference to the way in which they experience.
I would say also it makes a difference in many cases clinically to the outcome, because if a patient is feeling like they're being dragged through mm-hmm. something they don't want to go through, they're in the wrong place. If they feel that they've decided to go for something, they will listen to every piece of advice they're given about it, how to do it, they'll do it well, their compliance will be excellent, and so they'll get the best outcome. But it's not going to happen if they feel they've been bludgeoned into it.
Mm.
So very important.
Something, again, you've already mentioned, really, it's the appropriate support at all stages. It's mm-hmm. the all clear. It's usually a long, long way from the patient feeling great. And there's some huge gaps there, and clearly you are trying to address this, and there are very different needs at different stages, aren't there? And there are some big gaps at the moment.
Mm. Yeah, no, I think that's the importance of going back to a needs assessment and the importance of a care plan, and ensuring that that's a living, breathing document that's done with the patient. That actually at every point you can feel like there's a kind of good understanding between a patient and between the people that are caring for them, that they understand those needs are understood, and that you're getting the most appropriate care based on those needs. And that it's, we're not trying to apply a kind of one-size-fits-all approach to how you deliver follow-up care for people affected by cancer. I think that, understanding, as you say, that some people with the right support can self-manage, but some people's consequences of the treatment are going to be so profound sometimes, and for a long time after their treatment has ended, they will need more kind of tailored and intensive support. But really understanding how you differentiate between those, but not just assuming that everyone will need the same sort of care once their treatment has ended is vitally important. Mm.
So a kind of a overall way of looking at this is that healthcare is, up to now, has been a kind of systems-based thing, isn't it? We're improving our systems, we've got the chart, the trail, all this stuff. And every problem has been addressed in terms of changing or improving the system. But patient-centred care isn't a system. It's just not. And it does actually mean that you move the locus of attention away mm. from the systems to the person you're trying to treat, and you find out, you're actually asking, you're finding out about them in order to respond appropriately. It's not systems are bad things, they're great. Of course, you've got to have systems, and a great system will support good care, no doubt about that. But you can't process people through a system. That's actually really what's wrong, isn't it? The opposite of patient-centered care mm. is being treated like a number in a system.
Mm.
Yeah, and that's what people are objecting to, and they want it to change. So it is essentially a whole new area for the healthcare to move into. It hasn't really had to do that to now, but there is now mm. demand that this happens. And you spoke about the change as being a cultural one.
Mm-hmm.
I suggest that, in a way, is what the cultural change has got to be. It's moving from this is our system, this is how we do it, come along, you fit in here,
mm-hmm.
to okay, what do you need? Which is very different, and it's a difficult change to drive because it's so out of the box in a way, isn't it? And I think, you know, I said there were like 40 years worth of trying to fix this. What I think is that has been happening mainly in the last 40 years is that they've been trying to make new systems to deal with personal issues, and they don't work. They don't ever end up in real, proper person-centred care. So it's an interesting area, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what I think you're up against. You're trying to bring in this completely new view of healthcare and say, look, this bit is actually just as important as all that stuff you've been doing up to now.
Yeah, and I think what's important to recognise is that it's the relationship between what changes you need to make at a system level and how can that support you to facilitate the delivery of good patient-centred care. And I think one of the things that, recognising, for instance, that it was very difficult to look at prioritising at a national level, whether it's in England, in Scotland, in Wales, in Northern Ireland, patient experience without having the data to understand where it was going wrong. And so what the patient experience service allows us to do is you can aggregate that to look at a national level to say, we know this is really, really important. We know at this level there's a big gap. And ensuring that in the minds of decision makers and senior people, that at that level it's just as important as the clinical outcomes is really, really important, but it's not the entire story, clearly, when that is not going to necessarily impact on the change that's delivered, the experience of care, when you're receiving, when an individual is receiving their radiotherapy in a trust. But what it does do, I think, is it sets the right tone. And that's really, really important. And it needs to, at that level, be commitment to ensure that patient experience and quality of life is just as important as survival. Mm. And it sets the tone and sets the environment for really brilliant clinicians, really brilliant doctors and nurses to be able to drive that change and feel like they've got permission to drive that change.
Mm.
So I think it's the relationship between what you're doing at a national level, at a system level, and the relationship between how that drives change on the ground, without assuming that you can kind of pull a lever in an office in London or in Edinburgh and something will be delivered on the ground. But some of those things are important, but then thinking about what are the tools at our disposal, whether it's the Macmillan Valley-based standard. Once you've got that space and it's important, that it's understood that it's important, that you can actually drive the change on the ground. And I think it's understanding the relationship between those two things is quite important, that you're not going to make the change just by trying to make changes at a national level.
Yeah.
But it is part of the story. And I think that's why it's really important that it is a priority and governments are prioritising it and recognising its importance.
Absolutely, I agree. Yeah, so I totally applaud the fact that you're making the case for not just saying that the patient experience is important, but for saying it's as important as the clinical outcome. Because I think as long as it stays like just important and the clinical outcomes at the top, the drive for the system to keep going will overpower it always.
Yeah.
You know, it'll always be saying, well, it's important, but it's not as important as the clinical outcome. And so, you know, the patient experience won't improve that way. It's only by doing what you say, saying that it's exactly as important, then it's a very different scenario then, isn't it? It's not going to take second place. So it's a great aim. I hope you have a huge success with it. It can't happen too soon as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, thanks very much, Tom, for talking to us about it today.
Thank you.
I sincerely hope Macmillan succeeds where others have failed in addressing the desperately needed cultural changes in the NHS. It's long, long overdue, and perhaps, just perhaps, now is the time for the change to take hold. For further reading on the subject, please see the links on the Yes to Life website as yestolife.org.uk. Click Media Centre in the left-hand sidebar and then choose UK Health Radio. Another reminder about upcoming events put on by the charity Yes to Life. Do visit us at our stand at CAM Expo on the 24th or the 25th of September. And don't miss the Yes to Life keynote lecture on the Saturday morning, featuring oncologist Professor Robert Thomas and nutritionist Liz Butler. On the 27th of September, there's a Get Moving workshop in London with Liz Davis and Vicky Fox, exploring exercise as a factor in cancer recovery. On the 15th of October, There's an Outsmart Cancer Cookery class in Bristol with Jenny Phillips and Geraldine Curran. And on the 19th of November in central London, our annual flagship seminar features international speakers and is titled Cancer as a Metabolic Epigenetic Disease. For more details, look at the Yes to Life website under events. Next week, I'm talking to experts about nucleotides and their possible importance to those with cancer. It should be very interesting, so do make a note to listen. Goodbye.